pre-K through 12 appropriations sub, sorry, the pre-K through 12 appropriations subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, will you please call the roll?
Chair Fine.
Here.
Vice Chair Bill.
Here.
Representative Lupus.
Here.
Andrade.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Bush. Hawkins.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Smith.
Here.
Trunell. Representative Valdez.
Present.
Willight.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
A quorum, sir.
All right, a quorum is present. Members, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off or are on vibrate. Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have everyone back for our fourth week. Today, we're going to be doing a presentation and discussing the issue of school and educational choice, which I think is a very appropriate subject, given the results that we all watched come in last night on the election. I think last night, in both states where the governors were up, I think parents reminded us that they are in charge and not those of us who sit behind these microphones. So we're going to be talking about how we keep parents in charge today. But since we are the budget committee, we're going to be concentrating on the fiscal aspect of school and educational choice. Our first topic area is going to be an overview of school and education choice for K through 12 students. I'm actually going to present just some data, and it's, you know, pretty unemotional, and I'll just walk through it. And then in our second topic area, we're going to have an update and discussion on FY 2021-22 school choice enrollments and funding for our school choice scholarship programs. Again, some more background information as we start to get ready to do the budget for next year. And then as part of our second topic area, aka what happened this year, I've invited representatives from the DOE's Office of Independent Education and Parental Choice, Step Up for Students, and an AAA Scholarship Foundation to participate. We have the department and Step Up here today as part of our panel. Unfortunately, AAA Scholarship Foundation was unable to attend. So with that, we're going to move right into the first presentation that we've got here, and that is an overview of our educational choice through K through 12 students. So I want to start just by, this is all about laying the groundwork. I want to remind everyone there are three primary options for school choice in Florida, and the left side of the slide shows these options. They are public schools, they are private schools, and they are homeschools. If you're 10 years old, you're supposed to be doing one of these three. I think a lot of people believe the term school choice applies exclusively to the state's choice scholarships. This is, in fact, not true. We have a lot of school choice within the public school option. These include the government-run public schools, charter public schools, Florida Virtual School, and lab schools. So within the government-run public schools, there's further school choice that would include magnet schools, which is an elementary, middle, or high school that offers to all students enrolled in that particular school a specialized curriculum capable of attracting substantial numbers of students of different social, economic, ethnic, and racial backgrounds. There's controlled open enrollment schools, which actually most of our schools are, as we'll see in a minute. This is a school that allows a parent from any school district in that district, and frankly, the state, to enroll his or her student in and transport his or her student to any public school that has not reached capacity. And again, most of our schools, not all, fall into that category. And then there's virtual schools, a school that offers a program of instruction in an interactive learning environment created through technology in which students are separated from their teachers by time or space or both. For charter schools, there are two additional choice options. There's a School of Hope or a virtual school. There's also a magnet school, which we didn't have originally in the packets if you've printed them out, but that's absolutely a choice as well. On the right side of the slide, as opposed to the school you go to, these are educational choices that are available oftentimes within the school you go to, whether it's a public school, a private school, or a home school. And you can see there's seven different options here. Now, not all of them are offered at every school, but it depends on the school type. Some aren't applicable to a homeschool student, but there are choices within the schools as well, just to sort of set the table here. All right, so an interesting question people often ask is how many people go to school? Well, last year it was 3,262,883 students. That is the number of kids in school, not irrespective of where they go. So 85% of them, or about 2.75 million, go to a public school. That there are two components of public schools, to be clear, and we'll get into the detail in a minute. That includes government-run public schools and charter public schools. But that's 85% of students in school. Private school, 364,000 students, that's 11%. And that includes both those on voucher and those that the parents are just paying. And then there's homeschool, 143,431. That is the number of kids in school. And interestingly, you'll remember we had a lot of data last session about missing students, and I'm gonna talk about that at the end today. But this is data that did not exist last session, because homeschool counts and private school counts are delivered at the end of the school year. So this is, that data is new data for all of us. Slide 4 shows those same numbers looking back over the last 5 years. You'll see that except for last year, every fiscal year shows an increase over the prior year. And on average, the increase from year to year is about 35,000 students. So if you look at the delta between the previous 4 years and the year before, it's 35,000 on average. Comparing the total enrollments for FY 2021 to FY 2019-2020, there was a decrease of 56,446 students. And again, that is not a decrease in students attending government-run schools or public schools. That's a decrease in students attending all schools, including private schools and homeschools. Before we start to, and I'm going to come back to that at the end of the presentation today, or at the end of the meeting today. Before we start to review choice and funding in the FEFP, however, the next two slides will look at the 5-year history of enrollments for private and homeschools. And again, this includes mom and dad pay and vouchers. I mean, this is a total number. This is the 5-year history of private school enrollment. It shows a decrease of 33,550 students between FY 2019-2020 and 2020-21. So you can see the 5-year history of students attending private school. The next slide is homeschool. Not surprising. We've seen that in general because of COVID. This slide shows the 5-year history of homeschool enrollments and shows an increase of 37,316 students between FY 2019-2020 and 2020-21. But interestingly, it's been going up by a pretty nice clip every year, even before that. And obviously, these are people, unless they're on one of the ESAs for a special needs student, if they're not a special needs student, mom and dad are on the hook completely for the cost of that education, even though they pay taxes. Public school choice funded in the FEFP in FY 2020-21. This is an overview of our public school choice that's funded in the FEFP. For FY 2021, there are a total of 4,091 public schools statewide. To be counted as a school, each is a unique code number and reported enrolled FTE students in FY 2021. Of the 4,091 total public schools, 3,407 are government public schools and 685 are charter-run public schools. On the government-run public school side, there are 266 magnet schools, 2,960 controlled open enrollment schools, as I told you, most of them are, and 152 virtual schools. On the charter side, there's 2 magnet, 6 schools of hope, and 7 virtual schools. Slide 8 shows the 5-year history of government-run schools. This is government districts, FLVS, which is a government-run school, though run at the state level, and lab schools. As the slide shows, total FTE enrollment at all forms of government-run schools, and this is interesting to know because we know FLVS exploded in enrollment last year, but even including that, the number of students attending government-run schools in the state of Florida fell by almost 74,000 students between FY 2019-2020 and 2021. And again, if we pulled FLVS out of this, it would be a far greater decline in attendance at government-run schools. At charter public schools, the 5-year history, they actually went up. Despite COVID, enrollments continue to increase at charter public schools by 13,720 students in FY 2021. Interestingly, if you look at the 5-year comparison of percent change in the two forms of public schools, charter-run public schools versus government-run public schools, that you'll see that consistently the percentages at the charter public schools are higher. They're typically growing at 4 to 5% a year, and the government-run public schools are flat to down every year. Slide 11. Now we're talking to school choice scholarships that are funded in the FEFP. There were a couple of kinds. This is before we made the changes last year. There were two. It was the McKay Scholarship and the Family Empowerment Scholarship. Well, the second presentation will be about changes that we made last year. This is the five-year history of McKay Scholarships. You can see that they had a pretty big decline over that period of time. It's the number of McKay. And then the next slide shows the amount of money that we spent. But whether you're looking at 12 as the clearer decline, you can see that the number of students participating in the McKay Choice Scholarship Program has decreased. And then the two-year history of the Family Empowerment Scholarship students, because that's a fairly new program. Unlike the McKay Scholarship Program, the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program current statute establishes the maximum number of students who may annually participate in the program. This is referred to as the cap. For FY19-20, statute said the most students that could be in it was 18,000. A total of 17,820 were funded, or 180 under the cap. In FY2021, the statute allows the cap to increase annually by 1% of the state's total public school student enrollment. So theoretically, over 100 years, everyone would be able to do it. For FY2021, that cap was 46,889, and a total of 34,440 scholarships were funded. So there were 12,000 and change that were available but were not taken advantage of. And then this is slide 15 shows the amount paid for these empowerment scholarships funded in FY19-20 and 2021. Again, this is money that came out of the FEFP. Slide 16 talks about school choice scholarships funded outside of the FEFP. Two of them are funded through tax credits. Two of them are funded just on non-FEFP lines in the budget. Florida Tax Credit Scholarships and HOPE Scholarships are funded through tax credits. Gardner and Reading, again, we changed all of this, but Gardner and Reading was funded through non-FEFP. And now we're going to talk about the number of scholarships again and the amount paid. So the slide 17 talks about the five-year history of the Florida Tax Credit Program. Slide 17 just shows the number of scholarships. And slide 18 shows the amount of money that is spent on these scholarships. I know there's a lot of data, but I think this is just, even if you look at it later, I mean, I think this is valuable stuff for us to have on our hands. Slide 19 talks about the history of the HOPE Scholarship Program. The columns look big, but there's not a lot of students taking advantage of it. It was 488 total. That's not thousands or hundreds. That's 488 students. And then slide 20 talks about the amount paid for these scholarships. It's interesting to note on slide 20 that the total amount paid for the funded scholarships is a tiny fraction of the total amount of tax credits that were contributed. So people donated a lot more money than students were interested in taking. Current statute allows the scholarship funding organization to carry over up to 5% of any unused tax credit to fund HOPE scholarships in the following fiscal year, and any remaining balance can be used to fund FTC scholarships. So most of those red columns has been going to fund FTC scholarships. Slide 21 shows the five-year history of the Gardner Scholarship Program. You'll see that it's increasing consistently every year. And slide 21 shows the number of scholarships. Slide 22 shows the amount of money that we have spent on those scholarships. Remember that through FY2021, before we changed it, the Gardner Scholarship has been funded with GR in the non-FEFP budget entity. There were no statutory caps on the number of scholarships that could be funded, but obviously the amount of GR that the legislature appropriated determined the number of scholarships that could be funded. So when they ran out of money, that was the end of the Gardner Scholarships, and this was something that we wanted to address. The last two slides show the same five-year history for the number of recipients and total funds paid for the Reading Scholarship Accounts Program, which we included because it is a scholarship program, but all of the other scholarships we've talked about are, you know, you pick one. You go to government school, or you get a Gardner Scholarship, or you do McKay. You can only be counted once. This is something that it's that Reading Help Scholarship that you could get even if you're taking advantage of some of these other things. And we've talked about the challenges with this scholarship program in the past. But for consistency's sake, we've included them all here. All right, so that was a lot of numbers. But are there any questions? Again, and this is before we made the changes we made last year, and this doesn't include anything about this year. But before I move on to the second presentation, are there any questions? I should look around. Yes, Ranking Member Wilhite, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just go to, some of the comments. Well, first of all, my comments will focus on this state, not other states or elections last night, because this is the state we're here to talk about in our K-12 approaches. But when we look at when we talk about funds that aren't used and funds that aren't utilized, you and I were both here when the Hope Scholarship was put in place, and it gives me great concern when we have so much funding into it. And I think, as you reiterated your number again, only 488 students have taken advantage of that scholarship. Are we at a position yet where we start to reevaluate that, whether we educate parents more on opportunities to it? We investigate more claims of bullying, or are we to the point where maybe we realize we throw in the towel and this isn't working? And, again, I understand it's a great opportunity, as some have argued. I think the original argument was is it doesn't address the bullying problem. It only addresses the student that wants to move away from the problem. So maybe we should readdress the particular matter of the understanding of what that scholarship's used for, to rewrite it, or maybe to offer more opportunities for people to take advantage of. Because at this point, I don't think in the time frame that we've taken advantage of it last year, 488 students is really getting to the root of the benefit of this scholarship.
Thank you for the question. I think that's a fair question. I think it's worthy of some work. I'll tell you anecdotally, in my district, I do get lots of comments from folks who will consistently say, my kid was bullied or this sort of thing happened, and I was never told about it. So, I think there's it's a fair subject of inquiry for maybe for us to look into of why are there only 488 kids who need this? Or are there others who might benefit but just don't know about it? And I think that's a fair, but clearly more money's been put into this than is being taken advantage of right now. I think it's a fair question to ask why. I don't have the answer for you. I just was sharing the data. But you're right. I think that when we voted on this, however many, I think we were freshmen, I don't think the expectation was 488 students. I don't know what the expectations were, but I think it was expected that it would be more than that. I don't know why it isn't. We can look into that. It's a good question.
Thank you. Just follow, Mr. Chip.
Yep.
And obviously, I mean, we understand, and I think there's some other data that's been shown that bullying is on the rise, and we're blaming on COVID or mask or all these different things about what we're talking about, that bullying is on the rise, that obviously I think it should be taking more opportunity to utilize this scholarship when we hear of any case of it. But the other thing I think there should be some more education on is that, I recently bought a car and, they got to that line item in there and the dealer couldn't even tell me what it was really for, though, either. And so I think a lot of people, when we talk about the use of our funding, this is people's personal money that they choose to put that on that car purchase. If the dealer doesn't know what the purpose for it is for, yet we're willing to take people's money and put it into a fund that's not being utilized, maybe we could do a little more education to the dealers about where that purchase is done, that we're taking people's hard-earned money and we're not putting it to use because the dealer doesn't even know what it's for either. And I'm sorry, members, if the Hope Scholarship is money that you put a $5 purchase on when you purchase a car, but if they can't explain it to the person buying a car, we're taking people's money for nothing. And maybe this is something we could reevaluate. But I wanted to go to another one, if you don't mind. When you said that, and we looked at this, that the number is on a huge rise of the family empowerment scholarships.
Which page are you? I'll bring it back up on here. This number's small. It's right bottom right-hand corner.
It's on, 14 is one of them. Just in general, when we talk about the family empowerment scholarship, as I understand, that was originally, because we opened it up last year, that you don't have to come from a traditional public school, you could already go to a government-funded charter school or private school as well, that you can now apply if you are already in a government-run or private charter school and apply as well. So the idea when we changed it last year that you had to go from just a traditional public school to a private school, and this opened it up to anybody. So are those numbers artificially inflated because we now opened it up to another huge block of people that could take advantage of this funding, where I think the intention was is that we were thinking we were moving it just from the traditional public school? So have we skewed that data a little bit because we, maybe an unintended consequence was that we opened it up to a whole other block of people and we didn't realize all that money would be needed for them as well?
So it's a fair question, but the answer would be no, because the data that I just presented was for last year, was for the year prior to the changes that we just made. So that was the growth from 1920 to 2021. The bill that we passed affects this year, and I haven't presented any data on that. So the reason for that big growth is not because of anything that we did last year, because it predates what we did last year.
Okay. And you said the DOE representatives will be here to...
Yes, the DOE and Step Up. I'm just trying to sort of share some data. Okay. People are like, how many people go to private school? I mean, so we've sort of set how many people go in what form and who's grown and who hasn't, and then we're going to have them come up and give some presentation and answer questions from all of you.
I'll defer my questions to them. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions? And again, I have a second presentation which talks about some of the changes from the bill that we just passed. Yes,
before
you're recognized.
To the next presentation, I have a question.
Yep, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 16, where you spoke about the Gardner Program Scholarship, you stated that, I know I had a question about this on last session, and you sat down with me, and we had a brief discussion. Is that something that we're going to continue on having the scholarship program for the Gardner, or is it going to be something altogether different?
Well, we passed in the bill last year. We'll still have a scholarship that focuses on the students that the Gardner Scholarship dealt with, but we passed a bill last session to merge scholarships together and simplify the system. So there is no longer a scholarship called the Gardner Scholarship. I'm going to talk about this in the next presentation, but there are still scholarships that are as good, if not better, for the students that the Gardner Scholarship was intended to address.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Again, I'm going to have another presentation that shows last year to this year. Another chance for questions. Okay, I'll move on to that then. I know it's a lot, but we're trying to get to a lot of information on school choice. All right, so now we're going to talk about this year. So the update and discussion of 20, this was looking back at the 5 years before the bill we passed last year. This is sort of looking at now. So what changes did we make? So we made a bunch of changes. So family empowerment, we expanded eligibility to include the students that with disabilities that were available under McCain-Gardner. So as a result of HB 7045, we made these changes. This slide is a summary of those changes. The three biggest changes, again, as I said, eligibility was expanded to include not only students from families with limited income, but also students with disabilities as authorized under the McKay and Gardner programs. There are now two types of family empowerment scholarships. There's the FES educational options, or FES-EO, where your eligibility is based on your income, and there's the FES unique abilities, or FES-UA, which is the former Gardner Scholarship Program, which addresses your question, and beginning next year will also include the McKay Scholarship Program. It transitioned the funding for Gardner Scholarship students to the FEFP, and it excluded certain types of students from the statutorily established cap. For the Gardner and McKay scholarships, the bill that we passed repealed the Gardner Scholarship Program, effective July 1st, and transitioned the students to the FES, Family Empowerment Scholarship, in the FEFP. It repeals the McKay Scholarship Program, effective July 1st, 2022, and those students are transitioned to the Family Empowerment Program. It excludes certain types of students from the statutorily established cap, and it grandfathered FY 2021 McKay and Gardner scholarship amounts. So no student who is presently or was in the McKay or Gardner scholarship program would get any less money. It guaranteed the same, and in many cases, students received more money. Slide three talks about school choice scholarships funded in the FEFP. This slide shows the school choice scholarships that are now funded in the FEFP. The next series of slides will build upon the previous ones by adding to the five-year history of the slides the total number of scholarships funded as of November 1st, 2021. So I want to be cautious in showing these next slides. You're going to see oftentimes that the current school year, the number looks much lower than the prior year. There's a reason for that. The prior year is the full prior year. This year is sort of year to date. And many of these scholarships, they're getting applications all the time. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, but it does give you a sense of where we are as of November the 1st. So here's the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship students. Again, the first five, this slide I showed in the last presentation, but we've added the red to show how many have applied thus far this year. It's 86,952. On the HOPE Scholarship that Ranking Member Willite was asking about, 217 so far this year. And again, we're only, you know, I don't know, a third of the way into the school year, a quarter of the way into the school year. I guess my son just got his midterm report card, so that would be a quarter. The McKay Scholarship, again, you could see the blue bars were in the first presentation. The red is the number that we have thus far. There's the Reading Scholarship. People are just jumping all over that one. I mean, I'm not telegraphing my views of that one or anything. But there's the Reading Scholarship. And then moving on to slide eight, this provides updated data on the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program. Remember, starting this fiscal year, the Family Empowerment includes two scholarship types. This one is the Unique Abilities Program, and for FY21-22, a total of 22,068 scholarships have been funded, 20,041 that are included in the statutory cap, and 2,027 that are excluded for the cap. As of now, it appears that the funded scholarships actually exceeded the cap by a few. When you're talking about 41, probably is some sort of processing issue. Slide nine shows the funded scholarships for FY21-22 for the educational options part of the Family Empowerment Scholarship. The statutory cap here is 75,573 as of November 1st. 53,096 scholarships have been funded that are included within the cap, and 23,495 scholarships have been funded that are excluded from the cap for a grand total of 76,591. Slide 10, the last slide, just shows the total amount that has been paid on choice scholarships funded as of November 1st, 2021. So again, this is simply intended to set the table in terms of what are the programs, how many are being taken advantage of, and that sort of thing. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that before we get to our two guests that we have today. Are there any questions on the second or, frankly, the first presentation? Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
Yes, in terms of the scholarships for students with unique abilities and the current program, do they get any IDEA federal dollars? And how do they qualify for IDEA federal dollars?
Why don't you save that question for our guests when they are the step up in the DOE when they get here? They're going to be joining us in just a minute.
Okay.
Any questions for me on the data?
Chair.
Yep, you're recognized.
The money that is set aside, like I know we set aside money for these scholarships, when it go, what happens to it if it's not used? Where does it go?
So that's a great question. I think in the case, we talked about where, for example, the HOPE scholarship money goes. I think in the case of money that we're appropriating, any unspent money reverts back to the budget. And we're gonna talk about, for example, a whole lot of money that it appears that our school districts may be returning to us this year. So if we allocate money just hypothetically for 1 million students, mm-hmm. and only 500,000 were to go to school, where if we fund on a per student basis, the funding for that other 500,000 students would revert back to the budget.
Thank you, sir. And then you want me to save any IDEA matrix?
Questions about this data, ask me. But and I don't mind answering questions as well when after our experts have spoken. It's not your only bite at the apple. But if you have any questions specific to the presentation before I invite these folks up.
That's fine.
I'm happy to answer them. All right, so we're going to go. Oh, yes, Ranking Member Wilhite. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share some of your concern on the reading scholarship, obviously, and I made my comments last year when it took my wife and I 10 months to get the scholarship. It makes it a little difficult. Maybe people give up with most things in government, even if this isn't government run. But it was suggested to me potentially in the reading scholarship that in a lot of areas there's government oversight or they work in things or there's a percentage paid or a charge on things. Is it true that the reading scholarship is just a pass-through and there's no money made off of that by anyone, so that's why potentially they don't work on it as hard or it's not as, well, again, it's very cumbersome to get through the process. So is that done on purpose or intentionally because that money is, it's not managed by anybody where we would oversee it or make anything off of it?
Well, the people who manage it are one of our two guests that are coming up. So I'd encourage you can ask them that question. So Step Up is who does that, and they're here. Mm-hmm. So when they come up, you can share that concern and see what they say.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair. The slide that I was talking about, I'm sorry that I wasn't sure exactly. It was in this presentation. And it's slide, you just went over it here, on page 9. The Family Empowerment Scholarship, that shows data for 2021-2022. So is that in, that data is based on what we did last year then?
That is correct, yes.
So is that where the slide that I was trying to reference, that is that possible that kids that were already in private or charter schools have now been able to apply for that, where previously we took it away from just public schools?
Yeah, they've always been able to. What we did is we increased the cap.
Okay, so I thought last year in the legislation you had to come from a public school to be able to do that, and we opened it up last year's legislation to include private or charter schools as well.
Great question. They've always been able to apply, but they were subject to the cap. Mm-hmm. What we did is we said those will no longer apply against the cap. So when you look at, for, and I don't know what all 23,495 of them are, but certainly some of them are scholarships that some of them would have been ones that would have been subject to that. So they've always been able to apply, but there was a cutoff if they were in that situation. Now there's not. That's the difference. We've eliminated the cap for them.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so that's potentially their... It has increased now, so we obviously need to associate that with an increase in revenue to be able to fund those, funding to be able to support those additions now, correct?
Yeah, that's a fair question. We put money in the budget for that.
Okay.
So there was money for that. We anticipated increases, and we funded that in the budget to account for that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good questions. Again, it's a lot of numbers, and I recognize that, but I wanted people to be able to both here and afterwards as we start to work on the budget, just understand all the different ways people go to school and what's growing and what's shrinking, and so people sort of had a good a framework. So as I previously mentioned, I invited representatives from the department and Step Up for Students to participate in a panel discussion on school choice scholarships, and in particular, scholarships funded in FY21-22. And I apologize, I'm going to get your name wrong here, but Laura Mazik, and if I did not pronounce it right, Scholarships Program Director for the Office of Independent Education and Parental Choice, and Doug Tuttle, President of Step Up for Students, are here with us. Welcome to both of you, and we'll bring you up one at a time. Why don't we have DOE go first? Members, last week I sent to both the department and Step Up for Students a couple of questions, and I'm just going to show what they are, and I asked them to provide their responses to these questions at our meeting, and I've not been given these responses in advance, just so you know. The questions are in your packets. They're also the last two slides under the second tab. They're on the screen, so you can see the questions that we sent them in advance that I wanted to know the answers to. I would ask each of you, you can provide some opening remarks and then your responses to my questions. After that, members, I'll open it up to all subcommittee members. I hope you'll ask your questions, and hopefully we can have a good discussion. So with that, you can, if you'd like, go up to the microphone, and so we can see you better. And the folks on this side of the room will probably can't see you at all if you're sitting there. And Why don't you get started? You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Fine. And it's Ms. Eek, in case we run into each other again. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to, instead of having opening remarks, I have some closing remarks, if that's okay with you.
That sounds great.
So in answer to your questions, I want to go through one of our oldest programs, which is the McKay Scholarship Program, and just tell you how we've worked that since 1999. So currently, families are able to apply for this program via our website. Once they go in and express their desire to participate, their application is sent directly to the district. So they're looking for the answer to two questions. Was the student in public school last year? And does the student have an IEP or a 504 plan? If the district answers affirmatively, then they will give us, the department, a matrix level of funding, and that's how we determine what the funding level is. Our matrix levels and our funding levels are calculated by our Office of Funding and Financial Reporting, so we know exactly what each student in each district is going to be funded depending on their grade level per year. Conversely, what we're looking at now with the Family Empowerment Program being having some of our unique ability students in it as well. Parents make applications to one of our two scholarship funding organizations, Step Up for Students or AAA Scholarship Foundation. Upon doing so, the SFO, as we refer to them, will determine some initial eligibility depending on what the criteria is for these students. They're gonna respond to the parent and give them an indication that all the paperwork is in. They'll then send the list of potential applicants to be paid to our office, at which time our office will then share those list of students with the districts, because now, just like with McKay, these students are running through the FEFP. We also know exactly how much each student is going to be funded based on the calculations that, again, our Office of Funding and Financial Reporting have given us ahead of time. So basically, those are the two questions of how the funding works. So I'd like to stop now, and if you want to take questions before we go further.
Do you think you've answered, that's what you want to say to answer the questions
yes.
that we sent? Okay.
Correct.
Yep. So if you've said everything you want to say other than you want to say something to close, members, I'll open it up. This is your chance to ask DOE questions about school choice. Yes, Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
So one thing I want to point out, and it's not in the presentation, and maybe you can answer this question. Many parents use a McKay scholarship to go to a government-run public school. Do you know what percentage of McKay opportunity scholarships are used to go to the government-run public school?
I don't off the top of my head, but historically, it's less than 10%.
That's what I needed to know. Thank you. And then the IDA, Chair, the IDA question?
Yep, you're recognized.
Okay. So my question has to do with when you do choose to go to an outside school, what happens with IDEA funding? Does it follow the child? And then how does the school qualify to get those federal dollars since there's such accountability linked to it?
Okay. You're recognized.
Thank you. All right, so it's my understanding, and I did work with the Bureau of Exceptional Student Education for a brief blip in time, is that the monies do not follow the student. So let's say, to answer your earlier question about the FESUA students, those students that the IDEA dollars do not follow them, those students could use, if they're in home education, they could use some of their dollars to contract with the district for services. But they don't automatically get those services.
And can you
follow up? You're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Can you explain why the accountability piece and what happens when there? I'm going to leave that up to you, so I don't have to explain it. Like with federal dollars and how there is the paper trail and the services, because the parents are signing away FAPE. So can you explain that, please?
You're recognized.
I can try. And I hope that I get this right. So families who are parentally placed, it's my understanding that in districts, let's say for instance, our McKay students, mm-hmm. what we don't want to happen with students who are in a private school on scholarship is we don't want the district to count them in attendance because that's going to negate their ongoing scholarship. But for these particular students, I believe that the districts have some set aside for their parentally placed students. Mm-hmm. So those students could be served in the district, but using instead of an IEP, they would use a services plan. They're not entitled to the full plethora of services that the district may offer. It just depends on what that consultation has yielded.
You good?
One more follow-up,
yep,
sir?
Yep, you're recognized.
So, but isn't there, is there a way for private schools to qualify?
For IDEA funding?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I get tired of saying it, too.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. So.
You sir, one more?
Sir, yes. She's so sweet. I'm just looking at her having a conversation. I should have spoken to you before.
We only have till 3:30.
I know, so let's go fast.
You can always follow up with these folks.
I will. So I guess for me, sir, chair, is one of my concerns is that the IEP goals and objectives and all of the services listed in the IEP are implemented with fidelity. So what happens to a child who leaves the government-run school that has OT, PT, speech, language, all of those services, including adaptive PE, and then they leave, and those are funded, many of those services are funded through IDEA, and the other schools do not offer them. That's why they're signing away their right to FAPE. Is that what happens?
You're recognized.
Yes, it is. And we get into the parents' choice. So it's we're hopeful that the parent, when they are vetting that private school, that whatever services that student may or may not have been getting in a public school, that perhaps that private school can also provide those services.
Thank you, sir. Thank you,
okay.
Chair.
Any additional questions? Yes, Ranking Member Wilhite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm guessing this is questions on about anything now because.
Yeah, anything about school choice that you'd be interested in DOE's perspective, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for being here, ma'am. I appreciate the opportunity to ask you a few questions. I've got quite a few letters from parents around the state here, some from my district, some from around the state, asking so many questions about the funding and the opportunity for the funding to come in. For instance, one talks about how we used to fund in a block. Now we're funding in quarters. That makes it difficult for parents to... if they have to wait for that next draw for that money to come in. But some of the things that really are concerning is that did we really have enough money to fund the number of applications? Because I'm reading all of these and it's going through how like only about 25% of the parents were funded in the FES Unique Ability Scholarship, and they've waited 7 weeks for additional funding. Do we recognize that that's happening, or is that a problem for you?
Your
department?
We absolutely do recognize that this is happening. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to include my response to you in my closing.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you're recognized.
The same thing in the Gardner Scholarship where, there's funding problems for a parent that was originally approved. They went to another school that accepted it, and that funding hasn't shown up or come along. So here we have another opportunity where a parent has now made this school choice where this funding is available and the money is not coming. Is that something else you're going to address in your closing comments then?
You're recognized?
Yes, it will be.
And they may, and just so you know, it may not, if you have a question for her after her closing comments, I'm not going to preclude you from asking.
Okay. I guess, Mr. Chair, I guess the thing I'm concerned about is if we sit here and talk about K-12 appropriating money for families, and as a government, we promise these things, and now as a department within the government, these parents are not getting it, and they're looking to DOE to find out where it is. Not only should we be asking answers for these parents, because that's what we're elected for, but we should have answers for them. I mean, they're wanting to know where it is. They've made the choice. We've said you have the choice. Could you address a little bit my concern earlier about the reading program where I mentioned where, and the chair has obviously mentioned as well, such a low number of people have taken advantage of the reading program. And I personally have spent 10 months trying to get the $500 to help my son with reading why it takes so long and there's so many hurdles to get through to get that reading program. When we want to allocate money from this committee to help kids to learn to read, that it's so difficult for parents to get it?
You're recognized.
I can't speak to that last question, but I can tell you that there have been a great number of folks that we've enlisted help with to get the word about the word out about this program. I can't speak to why it's underutilized. I don't know if it's the $500 limit on what parents can spend. We have worked with the Just Read office, our scholarship funding organization folks with Step Up for Students. They've worked, we've had our K-12 senior chancellor, Jacob Oliva, who has spoken ad nauseum to superintendents. So I can't speak to why there isn't more utilization.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I'll give my personal thought. Obviously, if it takes 10 months for an educated family to get $500, that's why there's not as many people taking advantage of it. Because if smart people can't get money to help their child, they give up, I think. But my next question is, how many people have applied, or the number of people have applied that actually got the HOPE scholarship have, we obviously know only this 480 or something have taken advantage of. Have there been more that applied that didn't get it, that only these 480 qualified, or everybody that applied was granted it and got it, and that's only the number of people that applied is 488 people, families?
You're recognized.
I'm afraid I can't answer that question. I only know the data that we're given in the department from the scholarship funding organization, again, Step Up for Students. So the number of families that may be sitting out there that have applied that are waiting on funding or that they're somewhere in the process of an application, I don't know that number.
I can actually tell you a personal story. My oldest son was eligible because of something that happened to him last year for a HOPE scholarship. We didn't avail ourselves of it. We decided to keep him in the government-run school. But I was told, you know, once it's signed, it's pretty much automatic. That was not a difficult one. In the case that I've heard about is that people just don't know about it. I mean, because, frankly, it's the school has to let people know. And obviously, when that student, there's a built-in financial incentive. I'm not saying people are intentionally doing something wrong, but there's a built-in incentive. If that student takes advantage of that HOPE scholarship, that's a student leaving the government-run school, and that's funding that goes away with them. But what I hear about it is not that it's difficult to get when you're eligible, it's that nobody knows that it actually exists. Maybe a different problem than what you're having, that when you had with the reading scholarship. So just my personal experience.
Okay, and last follow-up, yep. Mr. Chair. And I think the part on our part was difficult was they kept wanting different things and just made it difficult and send back. And by the time you do it, it was 10 months later. But just for my edification, and maybe I don't know, are kids eligible in government-funded charter and public schools as well as in government-funded schools, public schools?
Eligible for what?
The HOPE Scholarship. Doesn't matter what school you're in, you're eligible for the HOPE Scholarship?
I don't know if it happens to you in a charter school if you're eligible. I actually don't know. But it's definitely government-run schools if you have a bullying incident. If it happens to you at a private school, you're not eligible. But if it happens at a government school, I don't know the answer on charters. It would be. Okay. So it actually is all public schools, you're eligible if it happens.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rep. Andrada. And remember, we still have Step Up to come and ask questions too. You're recognized. And we have a little bit of public testimony as well.
Thank you, Chair. And this question, I don't anticipate you being prepared or thinking that this question would come today, but one of the main arguments between folks who are, you know, traditional public school advocates versus, you know, school choice, charter, private school advocates and you know, involving the parents is that accountability, doesn't necessarily match up as far as, you know, standardized testing. And the obvious response is the parents are the ultimate, arbiters of what's in the best interest of their child. I went on to the Department of Education's website and saw that there is a link, at the bottom related to filing complaints relating to, a scholarship program's participation. And there are, a couple different groups that can file one, a school district, a parent, or a professional individual in the system. because this is an appropriations committee, how are those processed within the DOE? And does it come at a significant cost? And is there, you know, any kind of trends that you're aware of related to complaints that have been potentially filed? And is it an inordinate amount, or approximately how many do you think there are per year?
You're recognized.
Okay. Okay, that was a couple of different questions. But if you don't mind, I'd like to address your accountability. And I would argue that we have a lot of accountability in our programs. And I'm sure you know I'm going to take that stance. But our FTC students, our FES students, both in EO and UA, have to be administered a norm reference test every year in grades 3 through 10. And the results of that is sent to Learning Systems Institute with the Florida State University. And they do a study that they publish yearly on the learning gains of these students. In addition to that, we have a lot of accountability as it relates to private schools. We perform site visits for any new school that comes into the program. As it relates to the complaints, I'm going to guess, but I would say that over any given year, we may take in 100 complaints. 100 complaints. Some of them can be something as benign as I don't like what the school serves. They don't provide transportation, to a complaint that a parent has issue with a teacher, that there may be a teacher who's on campus who really shouldn't be on campus. So we have one person who takes those complaints, and she does a great job. But as to any trends, no. Probably the last few complaints we've gotten have certainly been around Rep. Wilhite's concerns about parents not getting their funding timely.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, I know you've already had a bite at the apple. So Rep. Smith, and then we're going to move on to step up, because I got to make sure we get to them. Rep. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and appreciate the presentation. And I know I'm as a strong advocate for school choice and parents really driving their education of their children and being more responsible. I support that. However, I'll use the football analogy. Every time there's a handoff, there's a chance to fumble. And with the legislative change that we made in McKay and Gardner and that evolution, I think we're putting many parents in a very difficult position as they make that change. And I guess I'm hoping to hear, it somewhat relates to both Rep. Andrade and Ranking Member Wilhite's question with complaints, because I do believe we have parents that don't know how to file a formal complaint. And as I hear in my district, issues with parents and not getting their money, they're being changed, the things that aren't being reimbursed that were before. And I get it, there's issues with policy and there's issues with execution under the new legislation. And we need to sort through that. But I'm just hoping that DOE has an understanding that during this time of change, and that you're willing to work with this committee and maybe others, because right now I'm seeing parents really squeezed with the education of their children making this change, and there doesn't seem to be. I guarantee I probably got 100 complaints in my district from parents. I think the DOE probably needs to do more of an outreach or something. I just your thoughts on that anyway.
You recognize briefly, quickly.
Okay, point well taken. And if I could go ahead and do my closing and maybe address.
I'm going to ask one question first, because I'm not sure that second question up there. I just want a quick answer.
Yes.
I want to read it. For eligible family empowerment scholarships, who makes the final determination regarding what scholarship recipients are included or excluded from the statutory cap? Who makes the final determination?
The Department of Education.
Okay, great. Now closing, and hopefully it's not too long.
It's not long.
Okay, great.
Our experience with scholarship programs over the years has shown a certain amount of false positives from districts, especially at the outset of a new school year. We've dealt with this situation by providing districts the opportunity to make any necessary corrections to their report via our website and by generating a follow-up payment shortly after the first payment cycle to fund any of those students that were mistakenly reported in the district. This year, the short implementation runway did provide challenges for all parties, the Department of Education, our scholarship funding organizations, our districts, and our families. Specifically, districts were presented with approximately double the number of scholarship students to compare to their public school enrollment logs. Thousands of these students had not previously attended public schools. However, many of the FES UA unique ability students have been receiving ESE services from the district and had student records in the district just for that very reason. Districts' existing processes for handling scholarship files from the department may not have been developed to handle the situation, since McKay students must be in attendance in a public school the prior year to becoming eligible for the program. The Choice Office worked and continues to work with district personnel to clarify student enrollment reports and generate follow-up payments when necessary, as has been our practice for years with the McKay program. Practice and procedures continue to be refined during this initial year of implementing these new scholarship programs, and we anticipate any remaining bumps in the process to be smoothed out as the year progresses. Our goals are that SFOs and families have a comfortable and dependable experience with the scholarship funding process, and that districts are able to integrate their responsibilities for their programs into their ongoing student reporting with minimal disruption.
Thank you. I think what that means to say, and I think we all heard it, there were some hiccups this year. I think we all definitely heard that. Okay, thank you. If there's time, maybe we'll ask you more questions. I don't know that there will be, but we do have three public testimony, and Step Up is here. So feel free to grab a seat. Come on up here, Mr. Tuthill. And again, if you can answer the questions that, well, actually, you had different ones. These were the questions that we asked to Step Up and AAA. So if you'd answer those questions and then answer questions from the committee, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A brief opening comment, and then I'll jump into the questions. We've made a tremendous amount of progress in Florida in terms of expanding options for families. And the families are voting with their feet, and it's been extraordinary. The growth is amazing. We're going to serve at Step Up. We'll interact with about 300,000 families this year. That's a very, very positive thing, and you did a fantastic job last session continuing to expand growth. The improvement opportunity we have is there's way, way, way too much complexity in these programs. Complexity always causes problems. You mentioned handoffs, Representative. We had a lot of handoffs going on here, and Lord mentioned a family gets approved to us. They go from us to the DOE. DOE goes down to the district. District goes back to DOE. DOE comes back to us. We go to DOE, go back to this, blah, blah, blah. It's a lot for families, a lot for us, a lot for everybody. We have to work together, all of us together, to figure out how do we create more simplicity and elegance in these programs. I believe simplicity and elegance is better than complexity and cumbersomeness. And a lot of what you're seeing is it's natural if you look at innovation that you start with a lot of complexity and make it simple over time, but that's where we are right now. My quick analogy, and I'll go quick, Representative, is, Mr. Chair, is imagine the national transportation system is all on trains. And we wake up one day and said, let's move to airplanes. Well, it turns out that airplanes can't take off and land at train stations. It turns out that they can't follow the railroad tracks, and they can't follow the signals on the railroad tracks. It turns out you got to build airports, a whole new infrastructure. You got to build a whole new air traffic control system. That's what we're doing right now on the fly. We're literally building a whole new infrastructure that allows families to be empowered, to allow much more flexibility in the system, and you're seeing the growing pains of building an entire new infrastructure. It just is what it is. But I think we have to do this together, and I hope that we can work together, and we will bring you ideas about how to improve this process so that we have less complexity. The other side of it is that we do have to protect the public good. And I appreciate parents got a lot going on. They don't want to submit. It's a hassle to have to submit documentation. It's a hassle to have to say, here's the documentation I have to support this $2,000 purchase or this $1,000 purchase. But we have to protect the public good. And so we have to make sure that we get all the documentation we need. And I know it's a hassle, but it's a fine line between providing good customer service and meeting their needs, but also protecting the public good. So let me run through the questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Sorry for the delay.
No.
Let me first talk about the tax credit program. We run four different programs, but the tax credit program is what the chair asked about. So corporations in the spring and into the summer and into the fall make commitments to us about how much money they're going to give to us to fund kids. families start applying to us usually in January. By midsummer, late summer, we've probably allocated Step Up about $600 million in scholarships. We said, we're gonna issue scholarships to about $600 million to $650 million. At that point, I probably have $120 million in the bank. But I'm hoping that the companies come through and give us the money. And we work really close with the companies. We talk about a lot about their business situation, but that's sort of how the process works. The way it works is, you know, they oftentimes hold the money to the end of the year for other purposes, but that's basically how it works. We have a $60 million line of credit. We've had to use that a couple times where the pledges didn't come in at the time that we thought they would come in. And so we had to use that line of credit to get through a particular payment. We pay four times a year, and it's exciting to make sure that this process works the way it works. The passage of the Family Empowerment Scholarship for the means-tested kids was a godsend, because what you did is you realized that we were growing dramatically, we didn't have the resources to continue that growth, and you created a state-funded program to complement the tax credit-funded program. The state-funded program is obviously much more stable. I have way more confidence that the state's going to pay their bills than a company who might, for real reasons, you know, they buy a new business, whatever, their tax liability changes. Every year, $30, $40 million that's been committed to us doesn't show up. It's a little bit stressful, but, you know, it's working. But you've done a long way to help us out, and we're really grateful for that. So that's sort of how that process works. Second question, who decides when a family applies, who decides which scholarship that they get? Well, they make a decision. We don't tell them what scholarship to get into. They do it. But it's very complex, because oftentimes they'll apply for one scholarship and they'll go to their school and say, I applied for an FES scholarship, but it turns out my school doesn't take the FES scholarship. They only take the FTC scholarship. So now I'd like to switch scholarships from this scholarship to that scholarship. I also have funding caps that I have to manage in terms of how much money I have for tax credits and how much money I have from the state for the FES. So we have to manage that also while families try to move back and forth. Family finds out that I want to sign up for FES, but I found out that I need to go back to FTC because FTC has two free virtual courses, but FES doesn't have two free virtual courses, so they changed their mind there. So a lot of back and forth. Or, you know, I thought about using HOPE. I wanted to use HOPE, but the application was so difficult because the reasons we talked about, so I jumped over. I want to go back now to FTC or FES. So there's a lot of back and forth with the families, but at the end of the day, they have total control unless it breaks the budget. And otherwise, they control that process. Describe the process and timing for notifying a scholarship applicant that they have been awarded. This is very complex for the families, and Laura alluded to it. So they apply to Step Up for a means-tested scholarship. We go through all their finances and document that they're eligible. We then notify DOE that this FESEO family, for example, is eligible for a scholarship. And we notify the family they have been awarded a scholarship. But there's a caveat in the letter. They oftentimes don't obviously focus on that caveat, but the caveat is it's going to go to DOE. DOE has to check with the school district to make sure you're not enrolled in a school district. And if DOE finds that you're not enrolled in a school district, they will let the Department of Financial Services allocate money to DOE to allocate money to us to put into their account. Well, as we've talked about, we had thousands of children this year who got awarded by Step Up. We told DOE that they're eligible. DOE went to the school district, and the school district said, Randy Fine is in our school. Even though Randy Fine wasn't in their school, we got false positives.
Hopefully not.
I'm sure you've been in the gifted program, Chairman. So that caused all kinds of, that caused all these delays. Families were obviously outraged, said, I got an award letter, I got my scholarship. You were awarded by Step Up, but Step Up can't actually give you money until the state gives us money, and the state can't give us money until the school district says that it's okay to give them money. That's an example of the complexity that we've got to solve. And I don't know why we ended up with thousands of children being misidentified. I've had kids on our scholarship for 4 or 5 years that every year they're identified as being enrolled in the school, and they have paperwork showing they're not enrolled in a school, but happens every year for thousands and thousands of children. So I'll let you guys fix that one. For fiscal year 21-22, is there additional capacity for scholarships? As of today, we have 23,000 funded scholarships available for kids in the FESEO program, and we have about 28,000 scholarships for the kids in FTC program. While I've been talking to you today, we've probably got about 40 or 50 applications. Even though it's November, I'm getting about 150 to 160 applications per day for a means-tested scholarship. The pandemic has made it all even more exciting in terms of managing all of this. I don't know what's going on out there, but there's still tremendous appetite for families to have as many options as possible, and that's why we're seeing unprecedented numbers. Let me just real quickly a couple other things, and then I'll shut quickly. Up with people. Hope application, I get reporters that call me every 30 minutes saying, what's going on with the Hope because of the mask thing? You know, they're all excited about that. I think a lot of the families who have been bullied are applying for means-tested scholarship. When we talk to our families, probably 75 to 80% of them, when we say, why did you apply for an income-based scholarship? It's because there's a bullying story in their background. So I think what you're seeing is part of the primary reason that the Hope isn't being used, and I talked to the Senate about this last year, the application process is challenging because you have to work through a school, and there's an easier way, I think, to get it through the income-based, and I think that's what you're seeing. That's why that utilization is so high. And Representative, I hear you on your reading scholarship. I don't know your specific instance. I suspect we went back and forth with you on paperwork. It's probably very frustrating for you, and our team has auditors from the state over there talking in their ears. I suspect that's what happened. But here's the other thing. The reading scholarship is $500. We get paid $15 a year per scholarship. That's the only money I can pay to manage that program. That's the application process, that's the eligibility process, and that's looking at reimbursements. Some families with $500 are submitting 8, 10, 12 reimbursements. So I'm losing quite a bit of money in that particular program. So it's been hard to ramp up the kind of infrastructure and staffing we need to provide the kind of customer service that we need. We just launched a whole new program. We raised several $1 million in private funds. I think that's going to go a long way to provide much better customer service, but we're a nonprofit. We have the lowest admin fee of any tax credits program in the country in Florida, and it takes time to make the investments that we need to provide the kind of customer service that we need to make. I think your criticism of us is maybe we should do a better job of asking you guys for more admin money, although that's not a popular thing to do. We're proud of the fact that we had the lowest admin fee in the country, but in doing that, you understand that sometimes the customer service isn't all that it should be. And I apologize for you that you went through what you had to go through. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm done.
All right. We've got time for a few questions. And obviously, it's a topic. Maybe we'll have these folks back again. Rep. Williams, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back on the caveat you spoke about and the confusion that we have for the parents, you give them an award letter saying that they have received the scholarship. Then you go to DOE, then go to the school. And the school backs up to DOE, and then they're not awarded the scholarship. Is it any way possible to wait until you get all the information back from the school, back from the DEO, then send the award letter to the parents to try to take out some of the confusion that the parents are having?
The parents are anxious to know, have I got an award letter or not? And so our language says, yes, you've been awarded, but we have to go, you have to go through this process. I have a solution. I will be sharing my solution with the legislative staff. I think we can overhaul this thing pretty dramatically and make a big difference. And we'll work with you on that. I don't want to tinker around the edges. I think we need to sort of take out a blank piece of paper and fix this because it's a mess.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Is it possible for you to give us some of the solutions that you may have in place that may fix this problem?
You're recognized.
I would prefer to defer until I speak to the appropriate people so I don't get taken to the woodshed and spanked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir.
I have some ideas too, having learned about this. So I think we're going to work on this, and everyone's ideas will be welcome as we move through the process. Rep. Lupus, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Toto, question on the means test and on the FTC. So one of the conversations we have all the time is about like universal choice, making sure that every parent has choice. Based upon the current income thresholds that we have now for the FTC, what percentage of students across the state are eligible for a scholarship?
You're recognized.
Probably in the 80% range.
Follow up.
Thank you for that. And then going beyond that, what's your, I know I'm not asking you to be a prophet, but speculating, you smile, speculating, we're not going to take you to the witch shed. What's your sense of what the market cap is for FTC? I mean, you're at 100, how many students are currently in the program, and what's your expectation in terms of how large it could grow? You're recognized.
As of this morning, income-based scholarships, we had awarded about 153,500 or so. If you turn the income-based scholarships into ESAs, it's going to explode. ESAs open up all new opportunities for families to do micro schools, homeschools. ESAs are the future. You guys, I'm sure you know that. And you're going to see the thing really explode once ESAs are available. By the way, you can also ESAs to purchase services from district schools and from charter schools. So I think you're going to see a unbundling of services in the public education market. You're going to see a much healthier public education market. You're going to see a lot of innovation happening. And when ESAs come on board across the board, you're going to see some pretty dramatic improvement in public education.
Okay, you're good. Rep. Bartleman, you're recognized for one question.
Yes. Is there, do you assist, I've seen the norm reference test, and two-thirds of them have negative learning gains, and they get to choose whatever norm reference test they wanted. Does your organization do anything to help parents make informed decisions based on their providers? Do you provide any guidance when you see a school that has negative 10% learning gains year after year? Is there any publication? Do you feel that that's important, or is it just you choose to go to a school with negative learning gains and that's it?
You're recognized.
We have on our to-do list multi-million dollar investments in providing families with all the information they need to make the very best choices. So that's a big part of what our plans are. We do some things now today. Obviously, I'm not in the business to say, you know, don't go to his school, go to his school. That's not really my role. But I work for the families, and I want to give the families all the very best information they need to make good choices. We're not just about choices. We're about helping families make good choices to transform their lives. And we know that for the market to work well, we've got to provide people with good information in order to make good choices. So, yeah, that's a big part of what we're working on right now. Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah. Will Hyde.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question. With your comments being said about parents using the FES, do you think it'd be better to move the approximately $70 million from the Hope Scholarship money into the FES if they're applying for that easier than the Hope Scholarship?
You're recognized.
I would love for you to give me way more flexibility in how we spend these dollars. And so anything we can do to give us as much flexibility as possible to maximize student utilization and minimize risk would be well appreciated.
Thank you, members. We have three public testimonies. I want to give these folks, I know we're out of practice to having a lot of public folk come to Tallahassee. So these folks made the effort to be here. I want to give them a moment. Emily Beasley and Barbara Beasley, I'll have you, if you want to come up at the same time. Emily is a student and a recipient of the scholarship, and Ms. Beasley is a parent and a former Step Up for Students member. So you guys are well recognized together.
Thank you so much, Representative Fine, and the rest of you here today. Emily has asked me to read her statement. She worked very hard to write it, but she's very nervous in this very big room full of
people.
I'm
not that mean. You can do it. It's okay.
She wrote, "Dear legislators, I love homeschooling instead of going to the testing school," which was her public school. "I love riding my horse Cherokee at Freedom Ride and being in the Special Olympics. I love theater dance with Miss Elisa and all of my friends. I like learning about people in other countries, what they eat, and what toys they have. I want to go to those countries someday. I also like to go to different places in Florida. My scholarship is what pays for this, but my scholarship doesn't work the way it's supposed to. Lots of kids like me aren't getting the money they should to pay for their learning. Will you please help us, and can you make a law where everybody gets to have chocolate cake every day?"
Representative Will Hyde will run that bill.
Actually, she did do a presentation for Representative Plakin about it last year when we were doing civics. That was her understanding the Boston Tea Party meant nothing to her, but chocolate cake is the world. So, to jump ahead on that, I did want to offer one quick not rebuttal, but response to what Mr. Tuthill said. He referenced simplicity versus complexity. In the FES UA former Gardner group of children, the Those are some of the most complex children in the state of Florida when it comes to education, and we cannot forget that when we make legislation and when we enforce rules and put things in place that help them and bring them forward. As I just said, you know, she doesn't understand the Boston Tea Party or why it should be important, but the importance of chocolate cake is an avenue that I can take to approach to teach her how laws work and why it's important that we have a legal system. He also made a reference to parents not wanting to provide documentation to the reimbursements that we ask for. That's really not the case. We actually, for the most part, fall all over ourselves to prove that what we're doing is teaching our kids in the best way that we can. Unfortunately, oftentimes there are systems issues, and I recognize, I want to put this out here right away, I recognize that Step Up is doing a lot to reinvent their computer systems, but right now, as a matter of fact, until yesterday, for the last 60 days, I've not personally been able to upload a receipt or proof of payment, so I have about $3,500 in reimbursements that I can't even move.
He's right there. You can go talk to him after.
His email has been filled. But with that being said, I'm not here to complain today. I know that when any time that a big piece of legislation is passed, that there's going to be hiccups, there's going to be unintended consequences. This year, we've seen quite a few unintended consequences coming out of the pandemic. When 20% roughly of the students were not funded at the beginning of the school year, it wasn't just the non-funding, it was the lack of communication around it. We give up our rights to FAPE when we sign off to receive the scholarship funds. And in doing so, we're also not allowed to engage the services of anybody that we can't pay for out of our own pocket until that funding is in our accounts to pay for things, which means that many families either had to go out on their own to pay a private school tuition, to pay a full-time ABA therapy, to pay $910 for equine therapy, or whatever, and just wait and wait and hope that they would get funded for it. I know that as a state we can do better. I know that the funding parameters changed a lot, and I know that the time amount, the compression of time when they're trying to cross-check and do all of their things, and parents, honestly, we're parents of special needs families. We know how to wait. We know how to be patient, but we just need to know what we're waiting for and about when it's going to arrive. We really want to work with our legislator and with our funding organizations to make this work. We believe in school choice 150% because we see our children go from wanting to be in a dark room by themselves for the rest of their lives and be sad to competing at Special Olympics on a horse and taking gold medal at state. I see my daughter with a quote unquote 55 IQ blowing doors in every academic subject that she studies, maybe except math, right? You're not too fond of math? But in any case, the current funding model, the compression of the matrix scores, the 253 matrix score, which was that center point for many of you, caused 94% of future students to lose funding. We are very grateful that the existing families were grandfathered in, but in my county, in Seminole County, that was a $2,000 a year loss per student. And I'm glad that CAPS came up today because with the funding issues that we had and with the snafus, there were kids that were siblings that were funded where the special needs student was not funded yet. There were some other issues around that, and I'm sorry, I'm jumping around in my notes.
And I need you to sort of bring it in.
Okay, and I'm sorry. So the CAP exclusions were not collected. So there was a loss of award money to those 94%, and we're just looking basically to be partners in this going forward so that we can make it work properly. And I thank you very much for listening to us.
We appreciate you being here. No question, there was definitely some snafus, multiple, that we've heard about this year. But remember, zero students, not 94%, but 0%. Had a loss in their scholarships this year who had one last year. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Last public comment, Brenda Dickinson, Home Education Foundation. If you could be
brief, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm speaking on behalf of parents who have customized the education of their children at home. And I won't go over the quarterly payments being a difficult issue for the families who were previously giving all their funds at the beginning, and they could choose the curriculum, make contracts with their ABA therapist and other people. But when you have to wait till November, it delays a lot, and they have to come out of pocket. And those services are very expensive, and some children don't get the services because the parents can't afford them. So if there's another way to do that, it would be great rather than going to the quarterly payments. The other issue for the former Gardner students who do require more services than the McKay students to be able to reach an education level is that they can't get an IEP in a public school because it is almost illegal for the public school to give them an IEP, because part of that whole process requires the student to be seated in a classroom where the teacher can observe them under the response to intervention program. They're not there in the classroom, so they can't even give them a score on that part of the IEP, which gives them a lower IEP than what the kids require. The McKay kids in the current McKay scholarship were required to have an IEP before they could get the scholarship. The Gardner students were given a 253 rating for matrix services, and so they didn't have to have an IEP. They could come in with a doctor's diagnosis, but under the current system, it's almost impossible for them to change there and get an accurate IEP because the schools can't give it to them. And they are now, under this new program, averaged with 251s, 252s, and they were all 253s to start with, but they're averaged with the other students that are in the school district that are in those three classifications. So it lowered the money. That's what Barbara was talking about. It lowered the amount of money that those more needy students got. So there has to be another way. And I'm not sure we can call it IEP because it's an impossibility, but there's got to be another way for the students who are in that program to be able to get the amount of money that their student needs to be successful. It's a big problem, and we've talked to the Senate about it, so we're hoping that some brighter minds than I can figure that out, but there really does need to be some work on those IEPs. And let me just say, for all of the parents who are working with their kids at home to try to help them reach the full potential, they are so grateful for this scholarship. It has literally changed the lives of those children and of the entire family. So thank you for the work on that, but I still think there needs to be some tweaking to make it possible for those children to get the services that they need.
Thank you. And we'll continue to work on school choices this year. I will again remind people that 0% of students that were in any of these programs had a 0% cut in funding this year. Not a single student was cut in their funding. So anything you hear about cuts would be potentially folks in the future. I want to close, since we're talking about school choice, the biggest takeaway I want people to take away actually has nothing to do with school choice. We're going to wrap up on this. Slide 4, for those of you who have your presentation. Slide 4, we've talked a lot about missing students, and that just popped out as a part of this presentation. This presentation shows that there are 56,000 missing students at the end of last year. It's actually not correct. Now, this data is true data, because this was all students, no matter how you went to school, whether you went to a government-run school, a charter school, a virtual school, a home school, a private school. When you added up the totality of students being educated in Florida, 56,000 fewer students were educated last year in any form than were in the prior year. Now, if you want to argue that the population of Florida decreased because of COVID, you'd be making a difficult argument. In fact, that number's not even correct, because on average, the number of students being educated went up 35,000 every year. So the baseline, we would have expected in a normal year that number to have gone up 35,000, yet it went down 56,000. So there are 91,000 missing students. And despite the fact we've had all these superintendents and everybody else say, oh, nobody's missing, this data definitively proves at the end of last year there were somewhere between 56,000 and 91,000 students that are missing. And unfortunately, there's only two explanations at this point. Last year, when we were talking about this, we were like, well, maybe they're being homeschooled, or maybe they're in private school, and we just don't know. Well, after session, we got the number of people that were in private school and homeschool. So there's now only two explanations for where these 91,000 students are. There's only two. Option one is they're being homeschooled, but they haven't turned in the paperwork to say they're being homeschooled, which means they're not being assessed to make sure they're actually being homeschooled. And option two is they're being no-schooled. So this is not in dispute. There are 91,000 missing students. And I'm frustrated about it because this committee and this legislature allocated $112 million to find these 91,000 students. As of today, $3.5 million of that has been used. 37 of our 67 school districts, including my own, have not requested a single dollar. Now, they may not care about the students, but I know they all care about funding, because they're going to come in here and they're going to mope and groan that they don't have enough money. So I want to put this in the perspective that maybe these government-run schools will understand. Missing these 91,000 students means that government-run schools, assuming they were all to go to government-run schools, are going to get $700 million less in funding from the legislature than they otherwise would. So if finding the students and educating the students isn't enough of an incentive, perhaps the $700 million that they're not going to get for these 91,000 students will be. So I want everyone to take that away. There are still 91,000 missing students in the state of Florida right now. So again, I appreciate everyone having this great committee meeting. I think we learned a lot about school choice. We obviously have work to do, and I appreciate everyone's perspective on it. Seeing no additional business before the committee, Representative Maney moves that we rise.